What takes it to the next level, that other realm of awesome? Well, that's our first guest this afternoon from Defector and the Distraction Podcast, David Roth. Hello, David.
Hey, Rich. How are you?
I am a little bit giddy. Exhaustion coupled with unnecessary time change. So I'm probably just jabbering on a lot of nonsense today.
No, you did great. I was worried that you were going to hit, when you were talking about the hellhole of social media, I thought that was going to be your segue, and you were going to be like, and here, crawled directly up from those depths is our first guest. So I appreciate you not introducing me as some sort of a skittering lesser demon and just letting the defector thing talk for itself.
No. You are, if that's the low end of things, you are up in the stratosphere somewhere.
That's too much. I am also turned around because of losing an hour's worth of sleep, which is embarrassing. I was saying this to you before we went on, that it's either like, I feel like I'm either extremely old or like a baby who's like mom just covered her eyes and I thought she disappeared or something. Like, it's just not a great feeling for a Monday.
I don't mind the other one. I mean, I think they're both ridiculous. Just, you know, pick a time and stick with it. But the other one I seem to adapt to easier. This one, I woke up and it was not time to be awake this morning. And then tonight, I'll be wide awake when I should be going to bed and getting some shut-eye. So, but I guess maybe that's because I am an old man and I can't adjust to these things. Or I've gone the other way and I, too, am a baby.
Yeah, I think it's great that we can just have a conversation, two mature men with the minds of babies talking about sports and current events on live radio. I don't see any way that could go wrong.
Well, let's see where to begin this afternoon. There's so much out there. Let's start with sports, and then we can work our way into the seamier side of things here. I'm curious what you think all of this means with the vote of the Dartmouth basketball players to unionize, and where do you see all of this going in college sports?
I really wonder. I mean, I think it's what I can say for now, because I don't really know where any of it's going, is that I love that this started with Dartmouth, the famous pro-labor institution that gave us basically every major Republican creep, you know, that... Laura Ingraham's alma mater now is striking a blow against plutocracy. I think it's great. But I wonder, it's an interesting time to be talking about college sports from this perspective, because things seem to be happening in a way that I don't think they generally do happen anywhere else in the culture, much more quickly than any of the institutions seem capable of responding to them, up to and including the name, image, and license stuff, the NIL. It seems there's another ruling against it where there's basically not an operating regulatory framework for that anymore, which is kind of, you know, exciting if you are old enough to remember when everything in college sports, from, you know, the ability of players to make any money, you know, for themselves at all, to, you know, transferring, all of that stuff was extremely strictly and stringently regulated. If you remember that, then the idea of there being no rules at all is cool. And yet also, the idea of there being no rules as a general principle is scary. And, you know, money and scammery tends to sort of fill that vacuum. I think the thing that I am most encouraged by is that the thing that is going to fill that vacuum does not seem to me likely to be the NCAA. And I think that if it is the sort of thing where players have this ability to advocate for themselves, if the idea of like a players union and sort of the general frameworks of the labor movement become the guiding principles there, then every college athlete is going to be a lot better off. But even if that's not the case, if it is just a question of wresting some control away from the NCAA, that seems like a win to me, just on principle. Whatever replaces it, if nothing replaces it, it's better.
I'm sad because it means that there will never really be a remake of the movie Blue Chips now.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could kind of still do it. You'd just have, the cast would be, I don't know what Nick Nolte's up to. I hope he's well.
Me too.
But I think there would be a lot more, you know, like fewer stuff from the late J.T. Walsh and the Scuzzy Booster types, and more just like, they would just all be local car dealerships. Like, the actor that played Buddy Garrity should be above the title.
I can see that. I could see that happening. Definitely. What's the prognosis for your Mets for the coming baseball season?
Not great. Thanks for asking.
Sorry. Not
excellent. I've been watching them some in spring training, and they've like been winning more or less every game they've played, which means nothing because it's spring training. But they've been able to do it in a way that I've been watching them, you know, with their 8-1 lead over the Cardinals or the Marlins or the Nats, which are the only teams they play. And they still don't look very good to me, but they... it's nice to be watching baseball again. I'm still at that stage. I mean, like, if we have this conversation, there's a chance that I'm, like, completely sick of them by June or July, and I just want to talk about movies or something. But I think that for now, I'm hoping that the guys that were good before they mysteriously became bad bounce back. I have no expectations for the pitching. The one starter they had that I would have crossed the street to go watch pitch in person is out with one of those weird shoulder capsule injuries, which are kind of mysteriously understood, and also in this case is going to be rehabbed by the Mets. So, like, I just hope I get to see Kodai Senga pitch again in any uniform at this point. And then the rest of it is all, you know, grab bag guys that they sort of signed off the curb. Of course, the thing with Major League Baseball is that two of the three best free agent starting pitchers on the market at the start of the offseason are still there. So theoretically, my Mets or your Red Sox could go ahead and just sign Jordan Montgomery or Blake Snell tomorrow. The Mets would be paying an incredible tax on that, and so I think they're less likely to do it. I haven't seen a good reason why the Red Sox wouldn't do that, but I also haven't seen anybody saying that they're going to.
No, and I kind of suspect at this point, after their big offseason of letting Chris Sale go, which I was fine with, and then signing god-awful Lucas Giolito as the savior, and now he's having elbow surgery. I wonder if they don't say now, well, why bother with Montgomery? Because we're not going to be any good this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is... it's weird, because I think they sort of overperformed last year. They're not, even though I think that a lot of the problems that they've had, I mean, I think for a couple of seasons now, in terms of just kind of unfilled vacancies in the sort of post-Xander Bogaerts part of the team's continuum, that, like, it's still a problem. You know, like, they're not counting on Bobby Dalbec to make 650 plate appearances next year, but there's still, like, issues there. It's just that they're not at that, like, punitive level of the tax where they couldn't afford to do that. I think
right.
The idea of, like, choosing not to do it, it's easier to sort of understand it as a choice on their part. I don't think that, I don't know, if I were them, I think that I would want to try to compete just because, you know, I think that there's some wobbly aspects to basically every team above them, some of which, I mean, you know, the Orioles won 100-odd games last year. They're one of the best teams in baseball. They didn't get better during the offseason. As a general rule, they don't. And the Yankees, Gerrit Cole is getting an MRI, you know, like Carlos Rodon, nobody knows what you can expect there. Like, there's, it's not that they're going to necessarily, you know, that the Red Sox are going to make two moves and, you know, suddenly rocket into the, you know, high 90s and wins. But, you know, there's nothing that says that they're, like, to me, they're not obviously a team that shouldn't be contending for the playoffs. The issue is that they're just in a division where every team is going to contend for the playoffs.
Right. David Roth with us here on Downtown. Knicks have had some struggles of late, but can they make any kind of a playoff run?
Yeah, I think so. They're good. They're down two of their best offensive players and have been for a little while now, Julius Randle and OG Anunoby. And Anunoby is coming back apparently very soon. Randle is running. He has one of those, it's like kind of like a dislocation related injury that kind of could go in any number of directions, some of them very bad, but apparently he's doing all right. I've been amused, if not delighted, because it's not beautiful basketball, by the fact that they have been playing like early 90s Knicks style basketball for the last couple of weeks, including the fact that they are shooting in the 30% range from three and not as frequently as other teams. But they played, Ray Ratto made this point at Defector today, that in their last two games, they've held three teams under 80 points, both of the teams they were playing and then also themselves. Now, they're 1-1 in those two games, but, like, they're the second-best defense in the NBA this year, which is classic Tibbs. It's just that, like, early in the year, they were kind of also fun to watch because Jalen Brunson was healthy and everybody was kind of firing on all cylinders. After they got Anunoby, I thought they really did look good. And now they're just kind of like a grunty, unpleasant-to-watch Tibbs team, but they're still tough. I think that there's, like, there's really something there. I don't know that they're going to win two playoff series, but I think they should win one. And, you know, the East is kind of good now. Mm. Like, that's an impressive thing to be able to do.
All right, I don't want you to take this the wrong way, David, but as I sat there last week watching the response to the State of the Union, I was giddy thinking to myself, oh, man, I can't wait to ask David on Monday about Katie Britt.
I was hoping that it wasn't sort of, because I was like, if you're going to ask me for analysis, I did not watch that. We watched a DVR'd version of Survivor, and then I later on found out more about it. I don't even really like Survivor very much. I just don't like watching the State of the Union. The Katie Britt thing is amazing, though. I loved the bits of it that I've seen. The delivery of it, I've read some stuff that was trying to sort of like parse it out. Like, there's an interesting blog post, like a newsletter post, that identified it as being the way that she spoke as being the kind of like tone that you get in certain like fundamentalist Christian like communities, that it's like sort of like a little bit breathier and a little bit more childlike than is probably accurate to how she sounds. This kind of ostentatiously, like, you're like, I'm just a mom, you know, I don't even have opinions, but I love my husband and I don't think immigrants belong here. Like, that sort of like weird tonal psychosis. But there's nothing that can explain the delivery to me, like the whipsawing between, you know, talking in these incredibly like doomsaying, ominous tones and then just maximizing the twinkle effect within the same sentence about other stuff. I think that it reflects, I think it's a pretty good text of, like, well, text, I mean, performance, I guess, of how hard it is to try to seem normal while saying Trumpist-type stuff. Because I'm sure that she is a talented enough retail politician. I mean, like, talented enough to get elected as the next person up in the state of Alabama as a Republican.
Right, to be the senator who's not quite as bad as Tommy Tuberville.
Yes, right. I mean, to be like the one that's a little more checked in. But that's like a job that you can back into. And she did. She was the chief of staff to Richard Shelby. And when he retired, she got the nomination and took it over. But the trying to come off like a normal person sitting in your kitchen talking about these sort of basic issues that worry all of Americans is really hard because this is not an issue-driven movement. No. It's like it's driven around Trump's cult of personality and his, more than that, like his sort of suite of personal and psychological issues. So it's hard unless you're him, and he doesn't exactly come off as normal to me either, although other people's mileage may vary on that, I guess. There's still a sense of like just sitting down and looking someone in the eye and seeing all the craziest stuff that you heard on TV over the last 5 years, and it's like in no particular order. You're doing like the David Bowie cut up thing where you're just running words wherever you want to put them. This is what it looks like. It looks like somebody experiencing severe psychiatric distress, regardless of how well appointed the kitchen is. I thought the kitchen looked very nice.
The kitchen was fabulous. I told you, I spent the weekend with high school actors. I'm pretty sure if one of the high school actors had delivered that speech, the judges would have said, yeah. Back off a little bit. Take a breath and just try to be more normal, and it'll be much more effective.
Yep. I love the choices that you made. I think you made too many choices.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. That's like it is. But yeah, I mean, that's a pretty tough gig, though, giving a rebuttal. Like, I remember, like, I think I have just sort of a list in my head of all the. I remember Bobby Jindal.
Bobby Jindal. Yeah. He was the gold standard until last week.
Yeah. And then, you know, Rubio getting up there looking like he was in like a hostage video, being like, we were being treated well with the water bottle and the whole thing. And I remember a Democrat doing it. I think it was it Steve Beshear, the governor of Kentucky.
Oh, yes, yes. Yep.
Moderate. Where he was just like in a diner surrounded by people in like basically between the ages of 60 and 80. talking about how they were considering. He was like, I just think whatever the stuff that George W. Bush said seemed a little bit much, which is like probably correct. But it was, again, like the optics of all of these things are so perverse just at baseline that you kind of have to tip your cap to Katie Britt for coming up with something that was not just weirder than anything that we'd seen before, but that really seemed authentically unlike anything that anyone had ever considered.
And then you look around and she is still pretty much mainstream GOP when you go to North Carolina and see this complete wackadoodle, Mark Robinson, now the Republican nominee for governor, who insists the Holocaust didn't happen, Hitler is misunderstood, and the LGBTQ plus community, well, they're all scumbags and we ought to get rid of them. And, oh, by the way, much of our big decisions are made by a cabal of part human, part reptiles.
I think you got to hear him out. You know, like, do I agree with everything you just said? No. But have I done enough research to know that the part human, part reptile, the reptoid thing, do I know that it's wrong? I suspect it's wrong.
But can you be sure?
Read all the posts.
Right.
Yes. I mean, he's obviously watched about 20,000 more hours of YouTube than I have to develop this worldview. And I guess you got to give him credit there. The thing that I would say about the North Carolina GOP, this guy is a donkey. I cannot imagine him winning. And it's amazing because that is, of all the sort of like late blue, you know, sort of pinkish states that could swing, like, I just think you can't nominate someone that crazy, but you could nominate basically any bank president vibe guy and it would still work. But the NCGOP, the National Republican Party has new leadership. One of them is Donald Trump's daughter-in-law. And the other one is the guy that's responsible for Mark Robinson. He is the head of the North Carolina, was the head of the North Carolina State GOP. And I guess you have to give them credit. I mean, they win because it's a southern state that, like, generally, I think, does trend Republican in the way that, you know, most of those states sort of do now. But the candidates, I mean, I think you've seen a lot of this. It gets more attention when it happens in places like Pennsylvania, where everybody sort of, you know, like, you expect it to be a moderate, and then it's like the weird Christian nationalist that they nominated to run against Fetterman, where it was like every picture that was taken of him, he's holding a sword for some reason. You're like, where do you even find this guy? And I think with North Carolina, they have a candidate that I saw who's like running for a state education level, you know, instructional board thing, who's like a straight up QAnon person, like still doing the posts, still doing the we're we go one, we go all stuff. And I just feel like that's one of those things where, I mean, like, it's funny if they're not in power. And it's not that funny because they talk a lot about, like, you know, putting people in camps and stuff that's like kind of bad vibes and, you know, not overtly comic to begin with. But I feel like this is the sort of thing where, like, I guess that is the base. I understand that that's, like, if you want to say that Steve Bannon's signal contribution to the GOP is that he's managed to turn sort of, like, low information, faintly authority skeptical people into both internet-brained psychopaths and loyal GOP voters. So, like, obviously, I guess credit where it's due on that. I just don't understand. I think that you can't have those people as your candidates because I think that there's still as many problems as we have as a country. There's more normal people here than not. I don't know how close it is, but I think that there is a majority of people that just don't want to hear that some Facebook-addled dork thinks that Hitler was underrated or whatever. Like, that's just not an opinion that anybody's into here.
Well,
we'll see how it goes. I mean, he still has to run, but got the right letter next to his name, at least.
David Roth with us here on Downtown. Oscars last night. Do you watch? Do you care? What was the best movie you saw in the last year or so?
So I watched a little bit of it, more than I expected. There's a bunch of great movies that we have not been able to get it together. We don't even have kids, but my wife and I want to see these movies together. And she's got, and this is no shade on her, she's not wrong. It's really hard to schedule a movie like Killers of the Flower Moon around regular feedings, You know, right. There was like, and so that's been like a challenge for us. Like, that's a movie. Scorsese is probably my favorite filmmaker. It's a movie I've been very, very excited to see. I revere the book. I recommend it to everybody, the David Grand book that it's based on. And yet we haven't seen it. And I haven't seen May December yet either, for the same reason that it's like, it's on Netflix. I could put, and it's short, so I could put it on and watch it anytime I want, but we want to see it together. But we're busy and we're stressed out and we got plans outside the apartment and all that. So we haven't gotten there yet. Of the movies I saw last year, I mean, this is kind of basic, I guess. I mean, I saw Anatomy of a Fall and some of the obnoxious, you know, nominated also-rans, and I thought they were great. But I really liked Oppenheimer, and I liked Barbie, too. And so I wasn't mad that Oppenheimer was winning a bunch of awards. I do feel like it's a little – it was not obvious enough to me that it was such a great film that it should be sweeping a year that was otherwise, by all accounts, very strong. But I haven't seen Poor Things either. Everyone I know who's seen it loves it. But so all I was doing was kind of it's like, I don't know. The way that when you're watching the NCAA tournament, you can find yourself, like, hating Baylor. And you never thought about Baylor before, but you watched him for a half, and you're like, oh, these guys, get him out of here. Like, that's sort of, like, how I wind up every year around Oscar season. This year, I'd actually seen more movies than usual, but ordinarily, I can somehow find a way to get dismayed about it, even though, you know, most years, it's like every movie I watch is just from, like, 1977.
Well, that was a pretty good year for movies, so there's nothing wrong with that.
It was. I've been getting into that of late. Like, I have one of my Christmas gifts this year was a subscription to the Criterion channel.
Oh, nice.
It's a great resource to be able to go in there and just find everything that William Friedkin ever directed or whatever. I mean, my wife goes to bed earlier than me because she's got a real job that she has to get up early for, whereas I write blog posts a few times a week. So I can start a movie at like 10:45 and just watch it until bedtime. You know, that's just like when she's going to bed. And it's been great for that. I've been watching a lot of movies from the 70s. I think just because I like how weird everything looks. Like, the whole film syntax is very different, and there wasn't the capacity to sort of like improve stunts or people's appearances. So you're just getting a lot of like a hungover looking John Hurt in the monitor. And I've been really into that. And there's a lot of, you know, great stuff out there that's like free, or free with ads, you know, on like your Tubi, Pluto, sort of.
No, you mentioned Friedkin, and I had never seen it until I watched, I think it was a little TCM documentary on him, and I watched Sorcerer. Have you seen that?
I love Sorcerer, dude.
Isn't that great?
I recommend it to everybody. And they had a little theatrical run after he passed, and I'd always wanted to see it in theaters. I never did. It was here for, you know, a couple of weeks in New York. But, yes, I love Sorcerer. I have the soundtrack by Tangerine Dream.
Mm.
Embarrassing addition to any record collection. You want to have to explain to people what you're about. But it's incredible. And that is, I mean, of all the, like, sort of practical effects stuff from that period,
yeah,
there really wasn't a way to drive big trucks through the jungle in a scary way except for driving big trucks through the jungle in a scary way. And you really feel it.
It's great. David Roth, Defector, yep. The Distraction Podcast, at the top of the food chain, nowhere near those cellar-dwelling people who live out there in the social media world. David, great to talk with you as always.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Glad we got some Sorcerer in there.
Yeah.
I'm sure that everybody was like, when are they going to get to the Friedkin stuff?
We'll do more next time. Thank you, David.
Thanks, man. Have a good one.
You too. David Roth with us here on Downtown to kick it off on a Monday afternoon.